answer to 1984 is 1776. You're listening to The Alex Jones Show.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is The Alex Jones Show. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, sitting in for Alex today. It is the second hour here on this live broadcast for Wednesday, the 15th of April, 2026. I'm very happy to welcome my guest, Dinesh D'Souza. He, of course, is an author, filmmaker, and host of the weekly show, Dinesh. He's also come out with a new article called The Real Estate President, Iran Nukes, and Leverage, attempting, I guess, to make sense of Trump's strategy and the way he approaches geopolitical problems so the rest of us can understand it. Welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The pleasure is mine. Tell us about your new article and what we're going to do here, because it seems to me like the Republicans have sort of abandoned the coalition that we built to get Trump in 2024. I'm very worried about the midterms. It doesn't look like it's going to go our way, and it doesn't look like the Republicans are doing anything to rectify that. How do we solve this? What do we do? We only have a couple months here, Dinesh.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about the midterms. I'd like to start by talking a little bit about making sense of Trump, because it is so customary for us, whether on the right, even on the left, to try to understand Trump ideologically. Is Trump an isolationist? Is he an interventionist? If he's an interventionist, what kind of an interventionist is he? And so on. And I argue that this is the wrong way to look at Trump completely. Trump can be understood more as a real estate man, a real estate president. Now, remember that a lot of people who voted for Trump going back to 2016 said, you know, we want a businessman. We don't want a politician. And I'm saying that's what you got. You actually got a business guy, but not any kind of a business guy, right? Trump is not a tech mogul. Trump is a builder. He's a guy who stands in the construction lot. He puts up tall buildings. He evaluates property. And my argument is that he looks at America as a kind of prize piece of real estate, with all the things in America as representing the assets, the sort of facilities of that real estate. He views the world as a large plot of land. And he essentially looks at the presidency as protecting the interests of sort of America Inc. or America LLC, projecting our influence, our power, trying to acquire more assets, trying to bring foreign investment over here, trying to disrupt the people who are messing with the kind of free flow of commerce and goods and services in the lanes, the real estate lanes of the world, which are of course the oceans as well as the air as well as land. So if you look at Trump in this way, a lot of the things that he says and does that otherwise seem bizarre now begin to make sense.
Interesting. So how would that relate to something like the Iran wars? I get what you're saying, and you know that is sort of what we liked about Trump, but obviously there's some major differences between a land deal or a business and the country. We can't, you know, declare bankruptcy and move on from our country, right? There's some pretty key differences that make a strategy that would apply to business or real estate totally non-functional when it comes to running a country. So how would this apply to something like the Iran wars? This is one that I cannot wrap my mind around. I cannot make sense of Trump's motivation here. Seems like it's ever changing, and we're not getting what we said we were going to get. So, how would this view help us make sense of that?
Well, I think the way Trump looks at it, he certainly doesn't see it as a war for democracy. He's not trying to create direct kind of regime change in Iran. I think the way he looks at it is that there are good Muslims and bad Muslims. Now, who are the good Muslims? Well, they're the people, by and large, who are trying to modernize the Middle East. And by modernize, I mean, quite simply, to increase the real estate value of the region, which is Trump's kind of compass, right? Trump even looks at the rubble in Gaza and he goes, hey, man, I see some like tall buildings. I see some coffee shops. You know, he doesn't say this, but maybe a Trump hotel. So Trump is looking at this as this is wasted land when it's all rubble. And he likes places like the United Arab Emirates or even Saudi Arabia, because those countries are thinking far more about artificial intelligence and robotics than they're thinking about, let's say, the Quran. Now, who does Trump not like? Well, he doesn't like the 7th century Muslims, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, the Iranian mullahs. Why? Because those people are all about taking a sort of fanatical ideology and using it to disrupt the free flow of commerce and trade and good relations in the region. I mean, a lot of Muslim countries are perfectly happy to do business with Israel, but not Iran. So Trump is like, these people are like a menace. You know, they're like, they're tormenting the free flow of goods and services in the world. We have to stop them. So when the Iranians go, listen, you know, we're going to encircle the Straits of Hormuz, we're going to, you know, block it. Trump goes, okay, well, you block it and we'll block you. We'll make another circle around you. And that's a way of cordoning off your power and influence. So for Trump, it's really connected to energy. It's connected to resources. It's connected to the price of oil in the global markets. So I think here's a guy who sees America's foreign and domestic policy as connected, as really being the same thing. All of it aimed at enhancing the property value. And by property value, I mean the lives of the people, their homes, their assets, here in the United States. Ultimately, that's what Trump means by America first.
I guess I just don't understand how this benefits us. And do you think that that maybe view is why he's seems to be a little bit incapable of grasping the worldview of somebody that doesn't think like that? In other words, he might be seeing this as a real estate deal and these people aren't, you know, developing it to the maximum potential, which would make sense from his point of view, but they're sitting there going, yeah, but it's my home and I don't want to give it up. You know, that's sort of an incompatible worldview. And I've heard Trump say this in interviews where he's talking about people in Lebanon. He's like, I don't know why they stay there. They're getting bombed. And it's like, well, it's because he seems not willing to, you know, understand the mindset of people in Iran are like, we'd rather live in rubble and not be subject to you in Israel than be in a five-star hotel and feel like slaves. I mean, is there something in Trump's worldview that makes it, you know, incompatible with getting to peace with these people?
Well, I think this stuff is really complicated because I think that the mullahs in Iran are not devoted to Iran as kind of their little piece of home. I think that they're devoted primarily to Islam. Now, who's my source of this? They are. They'll even say, they go, we don't care about Iran. We care about Islam. We are part of the Islamic project. I mean, Khomeini never saw himself primarily as an Iranian. Now, we in the West often identify more with our home country than we do, for example, with our religion. But that is not the case for these radical Muslims. Islam comes first. Their country, their tribe, if anything, comes second, third, maybe fourth. So it's the Islamic project that we're dealing with here. But even there, like I say, Trump is not like I'm against the Islamic project. Trump is like there are two Islamic projects. There's the Islamic modernization project. I like that one. And then there's the Islamic like death cult. I don't like that one. So I think Trump here is, you know, and it's very difficult to talk about Trump, you know, because you can't change Trump, right? Trump, we know, looking back at him a decade, two decades, three decades, this is a guy who has been shaped on the construction lot. This is a guy who's been shaped by New York City. He has a brash style. He can't be anything other than he is. So we need to assess who he is, what he's doing, and then ask ourselves, is this so bad? Because look, who are the most successful people in the world right now? Which is the country that has been coming up the fastest? China. China's transactional exactly like Trump. China's not ideological. You know, China goes to Africa and, you know, the United States for many years was like, you Africans need to join with us because, you know, we believe in democracy. You believe in democracy. The Chinese are like, forget about that. We'll give you $500 million to build a port. You'll then become dependent on us. And that's because we have financial leverage over you. So what I'm saying is, this is the language that Trump speaks. This is the language that he understands. It's the language of transactional dealing with people in the world as merchants and traders, traders, not traders, traders, and not dealing with people as ideologues.
Well, sure, but doesn't that clash with the idea that he's against this radical form of Islam? Because it seems to me like the Saudi Arabian form of Islam is a little bit more radical. It seems to me like Syria was previously governed by a guy who'd been to Western universities. Now it's being governed by a former al-Qaeda leader, and it's become total chaos. I mean, Iran, for, you know, all of its religious inclinations, was a fairly modern country, right? I mean, it's as modern as anywhere else in the area. So it seems like that can't be the delineation. it seems like it's more like who's willing to play ball with Israel, who's willing to make deals with Israel. That seems to be the dividing line between whether or not they're on the good side or the bad side when it comes to Trump's view.
I don't think that's it at all. I think that the way Trump sees it, the value of Israel is this. They live in that bad neighborhood. And because they live over there, they actually understand it better than we do. You know, it's kind of like some guy in the suburbs who is going to the city, but he's got a friend who lives like on 126th Street in New York. That guy actually knows much better where the gangs are, what alley to avoid, because he lives there. And so the Israelis are actually, they've taken the measure of radical Islam. They have detailed knowledge down to the names of people and where they live and who their uncle is and who they're married to and what they care about and what kind of pager they use. America can't even get close to that kind of specificity. So I think Trump thinks that the Israelis are useful because they inhabit that bad neighborhood and their intelligence on the ground is much better than ours.
But it's not perfect, right? I mean, they were wrong about the regime falling, right? That's what's been revealed recently with the new Mossad chief, basically the new Mossad chief and the old chief, current one, David Barnea, both sort of promised that the regime would fall immediately. We know that Netanyahu was promised by Mossad that they'd be able to sort of overthrow the regime through the color revolutions they were launching. But, I mean, both of those failed. So now, as a consequence of trusting the Israeli intelligence, we're in a bit of a quagmire, right? So, I mean, I don't think our reliance or adherence to Israeli intelligence has been beneficial to us. It seems like the thing that's directly gotten into a mess that we seem incapable of extricating ourselves from.
Look, Iran is a closed society, and they have been since 1979, as you know. The idea of getting perfect intelligence in a place like that, extremely difficult. I mean, to get an idea of how bad our intelligence is, the United States had no idea the Soviet Union was about to collapse. I mean, think about that. We've been studying the Soviet Union minutely, using massive resources for half a century. And we had no idea that the whole thing was about to collapse between 1989 and 1992. So I don't disagree that Israel's intelligence is probably quite imperfect. The second thing I want to say is that if you're not going to put boots on the ground, you're not going to go door to door, you are going to try to somehow topple a society from the outside, you're going to need to rely on the Iranian people at home to do it. They have to sort of seize control of their own country. Now, can they do it? Yes. I mean, we've seen it happen. Look at the end of the Cold War. I saw with my own eyes the people of Poland, the Czechs, the Romanians. I mean, they went into the presidential palace. They yanked Ceausescu out of his office. I mean, these guys took control of their own country. So I argue that in the end, we cannot fight for other people's freedom. They've got to take it themselves. We can sort of create the conditions for it, but the Iranian people need to do it. Are they capable of doing it? Yes. Are they capable of ruling their own country? Yes, because they did it before. So you yourself said that we have seen an Iran that is peaceful, that's prosperous, that's pro-American, and obviously that would be of great value to us if we could get that again. But we're not willing to put boots on the ground to achieve that, and I agree with this. So if Israel wants to go do that, they can be our guest and go ahead. I think this is a case where U.S. interests and Israeli interests diverge.
Okay, but we seem to be serving Israeli interests because, I don't understand how our interest was really served by this at all. Obviously, boots on the ground would be necessary, but none of the groundwork was done. I mean, the reason I bring up the Israeli intelligence being wrong is because that was the argument as to why we need to support them. But if they're providing us false or faulty intelligence, then that sort of does away with their value as being the knowledgeable ones in that neighborhood, right? I mean, if we're going to be trusting them for our intelligence, it needs to be trustworthy.
I mean, you're using such a peculiar standard to measure this war, right? Because look at this. Israel is a country of what? 10 to 12 million people. Iran, 90 million. Iran has massive resources. They're an oil-rich country. They claim at least the moral support of 2 billion Muslims around the world. They have tentacles that stretch far and wide. So for a country like Israel, to be able to pummel Iran is quite remarkable. Quite stunning, really. And for the United States to get into this, call it a war, call it a military expedition, whatever you want to call it, with so little loss of life, and being able to essentially debilitate an entire powerful country that's been a menace for 50 years, I mean, this to me is a spectacular success. I mean, look at any other war, right? In the Civil War, if the North lost 3,500 people and Robert E. Lee lost 2,500, this would be a massive victory for the South because we only lost 2,500 and they lost 3,500. Here we have Iran taking massive defeats. And the United States is losing virtually nothing. And we know, like, one missile comes through and, like, four guys are hurt in, the outskirts of Jerusalem. And it's like, oh, wow, Iran is really striking back. This is not what I call striking back. This is like a Monty Python skit in which the guy has no arms and legs and is still yelling and screaming. And we're pretending like the fight is still really going on. No, this is a remarkable case of the United States and Israel having taken, I think, a powerful country, Iran. And by the way, it's really funny to see it's the Saudis and even the Qataris and certainly the United Arab Emirates all cheering from the sidelines. They're even lobbying America to do more. Apparently, the Saudi prince, Mohammed bin Sultan, has been telling Trump, you need to go all the way. So this is a case where, you know, I might have worried if all the Muslims were kind of coming up against us in a united form, but they're not doing that. Many of them are really happy to see Iran go down.
See, this is where I'm confused, because I've got headlines saying the exact opposite. Saudi Arabia pressures Trump to scale back war in Iran. Mohammed bin Salman wants the U.S. president to lift quarantine of Iranian ports, say diplomats. Like, this is it seems like there are not two sort of clearly defined sides. It seems like everybody's being pressured by everybody else. I mean, obviously, it would be impressive if little tiny Israel had taken on Iran by itself. But, you know, they're incapable of doing anything without our help. They can't even bomb Iran without refueling with American, you know, air tankers. So, you know, I'm not that impressed by Israel being able to, you know, act sort of insane, knowing that America is the shield to protect them from retaliation as much as we can. So, yeah, well, I mean, I cannot see the victory in any of this. I mean, obviously, the fight is still going on because the Strait of Hormuz is still closed, right? And there's been no agreement. I mean, they've spent 2.5 years bombing Gaza into rubble. Hamas is still holding military parades. So, obviously, an air campaign is insufficient for any meaningful change. But we're not going to send ground troops in there. Israel doesn't have the ground troops. They don't even have the ground troops to take over the parts of Lebanon they've depopulated. So, I mean, this just seems like an abysmal failure on every side, and that Trump's just trying to, you know, save face by putting a good spin on it. I really don't see the victory we've achieved here.
Well, if you start with Gaza, you know, you essentially had in Gaza the equivalent of a two-state solution, right? Because Gaza had elections in the early 2000s, Hamas came to power. They essentially turned Gaza into this armed camp. And yes, you can expect that when Hamas has autonomy over Gaza, over 25 years, they're going to build tunnels, they're going to create essentially fortifications in Gaza. They're able to hide these hostages, even though in theory the hostages are inside of Israel. The Israelis can't find them.
Well, you can do a lot of tunnel digging with $35 million a month provided by Netanyahu.
Yes, I mean, I think that going back to Sharon, the view in Israel was, okay, let's give these people essentially a part of the country to call their own, and let's see what they do with it. And what they did with it is made it a launching pad on October 7th for an attack. Now, if anyone had done that to you or me, coming, let's say, from a hostile neighborhood, we would have retaliated exactly the same way. Now, are we going to solve the problem? No, because, you know, ultimately, I think the problem is in the minds of the people, right? In other words, if you have a massive educational indoctrination program through the schools, you know, you want to be a martyr, you get money for being a suicide bomber, jihad is your goal in life, we prefer death to life. I mean, if this is what you teach the children year upon year upon year, yeah, you're ultimately going to create a festering society, and it's very difficult to solve that problem in the long term. So I don't have any illusions that this can be easily resolved just by bombing buildings or something. No, you can't do that, but you still do have to retaliate when they attack you first.
Well, you know, all that, you know, is just to say that obviously you can't overthrow a regime through a bombing campaign. So what I meant by bringing up Gaza was just that it sort of shows you that what we're doing in Iran is just utterly asinine. It can never work. It will never work. So why are we pursuing it, I guess, is my question.
Well, let me ask you this. How do you think the regime fell in 1979? If, according to you, it's impossible to overthrow a regime, there was an Iranian revolution, right? The Shah abdicated. The mullahs were able to overthrow him with actually quite a minimum of force. So why is it the case that they are now invincible? It's impossible to overthrow them. I think you're presuming they have massive support among the Iranian people. Why do you presume these things?
Well, I didn't say it's impossible for regimes to change. I said it's impossible for us to effectively change a regime using the tactics we're now using. In other words, you can't airstrike your way to regime change. That has never happened. It happened in 1979 because they had popular support to wage an uprising. But we didn't have popular support this time, despite all of the attempts
to generate it. Let's assume that the Iranian revolution after 50 years is relatively unpopular. It certainly has its advocates, right? I mean, all totalitarian regimes have advocates. There were plenty of advocates of the old Soviet Union. The Chavistas, of course, support socialism in Venezuela. And there are plenty of people who support the mullahs and benefit from the power structure of the regime. However, it seems like after 50 years that this Islamic indoctrination project in Iran has not been all that successful. And there is popular resistance to it. Now, the popular resistance is unarmed, whereas the regime is armed. And so external pulverization of the regime certainly can produce an internal popular uprising to overthrow the regime. I mean, a really good example is this. The United States in World War II, in the early years of World War II, pulverized Mussolini's Italy. And it was the Italians who revolted. They're the ones who actually grabbed Mussolini. They're the ones who actually killed him. They're the ones who overthrew fascism and then switched their allegiance from the Nazis to the West. But they did that because the Allies were able to weaken the military power of Mussolini's Italy. And so similarly here, I agree. I don't think that we in America can bring about regime change, but what we can do is create the conditions favorable to it and let the Iranians finish the job.
Isn't that what we tried to do? I mean, isn't that what has failed? And isn't that why we're in the situation we're in? I mean, it's a nice thought, but it didn't happen. I mean, Mossad went in there and armed the rebels, and it didn't work.
Well, I mean, this is an expedition that is, what, a few weeks old? I would say it has made massive successes already. No, has it succeeded in overthrowing the regime? I think it's fair to say that Trump never articulated that as the goal. Trump never said, we're going to keep going until we get rid of the mullahs. Maybe he secretly hoped that would happen, but it's one thing to hope that something will happen, and it's another thing as to what your actual military objectives are. And I think our military objectives were stated pretty clearly. And that
is... Well, they've changed a little bit. Hold on. We'll be right back. Dinesh D'Souza is my guest. Don't go anywhere.
Ladies and gentlemen, you know the power of turmeric, but have you felt it? Have you tried the ultimate turmeric gummies? The delicious way to harness the ancient power of golden turmeric, supercharged with ginger root and black pepper for maximum impact. Each gummy delivers 125 milligrams of premium turmeric extract packed with curcumin, the clinically studied compound shown to support healthy inflammation response, ease everyday aches, and promote joint comfort so you can move through life with ease. We added real ginger root, trusted for centuries to calm digestion and soothe the stomach, plus a precise dose of black pepper extract with pepperine, proven to boost curcumin absorption by up to 2,000%. That means more of the good stuff actually gets where your body needs it. No capsules, no bitter aftertaste, just one tasty tropical-flavored gummy a day, or two if you're feeling extra, to help you feel lighter, looser, and more energized. Ultimate Turmeric Gummies, ancient wisdom meets modern science in the best-tasting form possible. Grab yours today and start feeling the ultimate difference in health. With Ultimate Turmeric Gummies, inflammation doesn't stand a chance. Get yours today at thealexjonesstore.com.